God's Pocket is set in the Philadelphia neighborhood known as Devil's Pocket, just behind the South Street Bridge. A 69-year-old black construction worker murders a white punk after the kid held a razor to the older man's throat, leaving a thin line of blood. The construction crew covers for the old man. They know he's a good man who's been pushed too far. The crew swears the kid's death was an accident. They say he died when a pipe came loose and fell on his head. Richard Shelburne, a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily Times, who hates new journalism, sees himself as the voice of the neighborhood working man, goes to God's Pocket, determined to write a story that will give meaning to the kid's unheralded death. Pete Dexter grew up in South Dakota and graduated from the University of South Dakota. He got his first reporting job at the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale. Then, when the paper folded, he wrote for the Daytona Beach Journal. He moved to Philadelphia to write for the Daily News in 1975. He was a reporter until Gil Spencer became the editor of the News in about 76 and gave Dexter a column. This year, Dexter also began writing a monthly column for Esquire called Sports Scene. Dexter's new novel, God's Pocket, is published by Random House. Pete Dexter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. The Sun Sentinel didn't fold. I folded.
You folded.
Yeah,
oh,
it didn't
okay.
fold.
Well, I wish them the best then.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you describe the novel in your words?
Well, it's a hard thing to describe a novel, as I said, because it is a description of itself, and it's written, you know, as clearly and as concisely as I can describe it. I think it's about isolation. A lot of it's about isolation. The kind of things that happen to people when they're isolated, and what happens to a community when it's isolated, which is the case in God's Pocket, and which is the case in a lot of little neighborhoods. Not a lot, a few little neighborhoods in Philadelphia. There's a line in there where there's some people in there as soon take a bus to Center City as to Cuba. People just don't go out of that neighborhood, and people don't go in, you know, unless they, you know, without a reason. And I think that breeds a kind of that breeds some pretty strange characters and some pretty strange events, you know, come out of that.
Is it the neighborhood behind the South Street Bridge that you had in mind?
Not specifically. It doesn't correspond one to one to Devil's Pocket. It's not really in that neighborhood, you know. But that is the neighborhood I had in mind. But it's one of several.
There's a bromide that says that your first novel should either be about yourself or people who you know very well or a place that you know very well. Do you think that you follow that in this book?
Well, I think I know the people. It's not about myself. And I don't know how well I know Philadelphia yet. You know, I might think I know it better than I do, but I do know these people.
There's a columnist who's one of the main characters in the book, and I'd like to ask you to read the description of him that you write when he first enters the novel.
All right. That wasn't part of the description. Richard Shelburne was the most famous newspaper columnist in Philadelphia. He was famous for his drinking and for getting pissed off at the government and for standing up for the little guy. People said he used to be a little guy himself and never forgot where he came from. And he wrote things that made old women cry and things that made street people laugh. With Richard Shelburne, there was always something to get pissed off at. Some mornings, Mickey would be delivering, and every bar he went into, they'd ask him, did he read Richard Shelburne yet? When he hadn't, they'd stick the Daily Times in his face and tell him what Richard Shelburne had said while he read it. That's exactly what everybody's thinking, they'd say. He's the only guy who knows what it's like out here.
How would you compare yourself to Richard Shelburne, the columnist that you've created for your novel?
Well, I think that I hope there's not much of a comparison. I think Richard Shelburne is somebody I could have turned into. You can be seduced into thinking that, you know, you're more important than you are. You can be seduced into thinking people really care about you that, you know, that don't know you. And I've seen that happen to a lot of people. And if you're seduced that way for long enough, then you don't have any place to go. I mean, you can't get out of that because that is your life and that's what it is. And that's, you know, the columnist in this book is a 53-year-old man who doesn't have a single thing in this world except his column, which he hates to write. and I'm not 53. And sometimes I hate to write my column, but I, you know, I don't depend on it for my, I don't depend on it for my happiness.
He hates new journalism. What does he have in mind when he's thinking about new journalism?
He doesn't know what it is. It's just a threat. It's somebody who might try to take his column away.
And do you have any opinions on the matter?
On new journalists?
Yeah, or is that an old issue?
Well, yeah, it's an old issue, but the when new journalism first showed up, I mean, to me, all it means is that you're writing factual things in a the style you're using is a fiction-like style, and I think you know when the regular bounds of truth and accuracy I think they still apply, and when that's done, I think it's great.
Have you ever done anything like the columnist in your book did, which is to go in and try to write a story about a murder and understand what happened?
Sure. Yeah, I do that all. Well, I do that all the time. I've done that a lot.
He kind of finds out that there's some stories you shouldn't stick your nose into. Have you ever felt that way doing a story?
I don't think that's what he finds out. I don't think he really sticks his nose into it. I think what he does is go and take a quick look, and then he tries to go back and write in some kind of a condescending, he doesn't consciously do it condescendingly, but he goes back and he just goes back to what he's stored in his mind and rewrites the same story that he's written 100 times before. And once you start taking the stories for granted and start not looking at them, then you might as well just stay in the office.
Do you think that a lot of writing in support of the common man, the working person, is in fact condescending in the way that it's written?
Some of it is and some of it isn't. I don't think mine is because I don't really feel, I mean, I'm not capable of condensation that way. Wait a minute, condensation means that.
Condescension is.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, condensation I am capable of, not condensation. Yeah, no, because, you know, I really feel like, I mean, I've worked all my life. I've done a lot of hard work, and I don't feel any different from those people.
The novel set in Philadelphia, and there probably haven't been that many novels set in the city that that have really caught on. Would you like to see Philadelphia get some kind of literary reputation, you know, as a city that's known through books written about it, books set in it?
Not especially. I just take Philadelphia the way it is. I wouldn't, you know, I don't think about changing it. I wouldn't like to see it, you know, become New York. Mm-hmm. I think it's got some nice things about it the way it is, and I don't think it has to become a center for writers.
Did you find when you were writing your novel that any of the columns that you were writing happened to coincide with what was happening in your novel?
How do you mean? I'm sorry.
Well, that a similar story was breaking in your real life as was in the novel, or that a similar issue presented itself in your life.
Well, in a way, I mean, the central character of this novel is a guy that drives a meat truck. His name is Mickey Scarpato, and a lot of most of what he thinks and sees is what I think and see. And it doesn't make me feel real good to pick up a real positive review. But they talk about this 2-time loser without, you know, any imagination or without any insight, and they're talking about Mickey Scarpato, who, you know, is me. But the actual issues, no. I mean, there's a couple of things in this book that appeared in columns, not word for word, but a couple of the ideas came from columns, but no.
Philadelphia Daily News columnist Pete Dexter is my guest, and we're discussing his new novel, God's Pocket, which has just been published by Random House. You got to Philadelphia in 1975 or so, and when you moved here, you were a reporter and became a columnist in 76 when Gail Spencer became the editor. Was that a desirable switch for you from reporter to columnist?
Yeah, they had me coming in at 7 o'clock in the morning, calling up gas stations to find out how much regular was and how much ethyl was and how much unleaded was. And I'd get it all screwed up. And I'd never have, it was just, I don't know why they were doing that with me. But Spencer came in and he didn't immediately change me to a columnist. I mean, he was told right when he came in to look out. because I was trouble. And but he, to his credit, you know, he gave me a chance, and to do some things. And when I did those, then he, you know, we kind of worked into a column. But it didn't just happen when he came in.
What kind of trouble did you have a reputation for creating?
Oh, I'm not easy to get along with when you got me calling up people at 7 o'clock in the morning to ask how much gas costs. And I'm not, you know, there's just some, I've never been somebody who just, I've never been particularly somebody who enjoys being part of I'm just not the ideal person to have around an office when you've got everybody all kind of marching one way. And I mean, when it's a forced march, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, I'm gonna be the guy that drags behind.
Did you start to see the city differently when you became a columnist and you had to draw from the city every day?
Well, you know, you begin to see more of the city all the time, but I would think that that's probably from just being here longer.
What would you do to try to understand, like, the different neighborhoods and communities?
You go into them. You don't ask a lot of questions, and you don't make a spectacle yourself. You just watch. I think that's about all you can do. I mean, if you asked me to explain myself, I couldn't. And I certainly can't go into a, you know, fish town or Port Richmond or something and ask those people to explain themselves. I mean, first place, they, you know, they probably can't any better than I can. The second place, you know, they certainly probably, you know, they wouldn't want to.
Did you find them to be closed to outsiders?
Sure, a lot of those places are, well, not closed, but they're real suspicious to outsiders. And, you know, they want to know who you are. And if they know you from the daily news, that, you know, kind of, it'll change the way they act toward you sometimes. Until they get to know you, and then, not that I'm a frequent visitor in Port Richmond or Kensington or any of those places right now. But the places I go when I'm known, you know, in certain places in South Philadelphia, people are themselves with me.
Are there places that you feel an affinity with in Philadelphia?
Sure. You know, most of South Philadelphia. Parts of Center City. Yeah, I like, you know, I like large sections of this city.
Is there a kind of story that is of interest to you? Like a certain kind of thing that you look for in a story?
Not one thing. I like things that are funny. I like things that are, that have, you know, some justice to them. I like things where people tell the truth. I'm especially fond of people that tell the truth when it's not easy. And I look for that.
When you're looking for an idea, you know, and you don't know what you're going to write about that day. Is there a kind of place that's good to go to just hang out and see what develops?
Well, if I'm looking for an idea, the place I go is to the newspaper usually. You know, not just our paper, but if there's something going on. And, or, you know, I used to get a six-pack of beer and just drive around and pick up people and talk to them. And, you know, you can get stories that way. You can go watch a playground and pick up a basketball game on a playground and get a story. There's all kinds of ways to do it.
Are bars good places to go to for stories?
Yeah, they're great.
What's good about them?
Well, there's, I mean, on good nights you can have 200 people together without an inhibition there, and, you know, people saying, you know, things that they didn't even know they meant, and sometimes they don't mean. You know, people with, you know, displaying talents that they wouldn't normally display. You know, you have people singing and dancing, crying and fighting and, you know, telling you all kinds of stuff. And sometimes it can go the other way. I mean, you can just get somebody that's right in your ear and won't leave you alone, and that's not much good. But yeah, you see some great things in bars.
I think that some people think that if you go to a bar, you're going to find real people there, you know, as if you go someplace else, the people will be less real. Do you think that it's almost become a cliche in journalism to go to the bar to find what real people are thinking on a subject?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the people staying at home or minding the kids and making supper or watching TV are just as real as anybody else.
Would the bars that you go to for just to hang out and see if anything interesting develops be the kind of bars that would have women in them too? Because some bars are still like traditionally male bars where what you get would mostly be
Yeah, I don't even know any bars like that. Really? Yeah, all the bars that I know, yeah, have both sexes.
Uh-huh.
And those would, yeah, those would be the, I just go places where things, you know, where there's some energy and some things going on.
Do you like to be known as a writer at those places where you hang out? Or would you rather be as invisible as possible?
I don't know. I've gotten used to being known as a writer, and I don't think it gets in the way of anything anymore because, you know, the people I know don't look at me that way. I'm not interested in going someplace and saying, hey, there's Pete Dexter, a writer. That doesn't do a thing for me.
What are some of the columns that you've written that have created the biggest uproar among your readers?
Oh, brother. Listen, the first big one was about 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. I wrote a column about, there was a group called Wages for Lesbians who wanted to be paid $17,000 or $18,000 a year by the government because they were lesbians. And I tried to go to one of their meetings, and they wouldn't let me in because they said it was men that did the raping in our society, and the women there didn't want to have to look at rapers while they were talking about this. And so I said, all right, and I went back and wrote a column about that. And they really got angry. And they came in for a meeting, about 30 of them, and then they wrote two or three letters to the editor about it, saying I distorted the size of their meeting. I'd said there were 30 people, and they said there were 50, and I distorted, you know, what they were doing. So I wrote another column, which really got, I mean, I got stuck because I said, I don't know where, you have to wonder where 20 missing heads would be at a meeting of lesbians. Well, next thing I knew, I turned on the news the next day on television. I got, you know, at noon when I finished working, I turned on the news, and the first thing I heard, the picture wasn't even on yet, was and a spokesman for the Daily News said Dexter would not be fired. And I thought, boy, that's you know, that's real local news. And by the time I got in there, the picket lines were still outside, and people with bullhorns were screaming that the Daily News, you know, was employing an admitted rapist. And it was just it was one of the strangest in most volatile situations.
Was it Wages for Housework or Wages for Lesbians?
Wages for Lesbians. Well, there were two groups together, but it was the Wages for Lesbians people, I think.
It wasn't Lesbians Working for Wages for Housework?
Not that I remember, but we're talking about 5 or 6 years.
Did you feel that it was justified for a group of women to ask a man to not be in on the meeting, or for any group to ask the press to not be in on the meeting?
No, sure, but you know, they sent press releases inviting the press to this meeting. It wasn't something I walked into, and when I got there, they said we only met women members of the press, and that's not justified, no.
What are some other columns that have generated an uproar?
Oh.
Well, I can think of one, and my memory isn't so straight on this. So maybe you can like retell the story as it happened. But I remember a couple of columns about I think someone hit you at a bar, and you went back afterwards with, was it a boxer friend of yours, and ended up in the hospital for a while.
Yeah.
Would you tell that story? Because I just don't remember it that clearly.
Yeah. Well, that didn't generate any conflict. And that didn't generate a column. That was something that happened. It, you know, I won't go into the particulars except to say that, you know, I got some phone calls that were threatening, and I went, oh, you know, if you threaten me, I'm going to come see you, because that's, you know, I don't live that other way. And when I got there, there were 4 or 5 people, and without going into it, I got hurt a little bit, lost a couple of teeth, but I wasn't hurt bad. And I went to a party that night, and a friend of mine who was a boxer, and he said, well, you want to go straighten it out? So I said, all right. And so we went back, and a bunch of people came in with baseball bats and crowbars, about 30 people. And he ended up with a broken arm, and I ended up with a broken leg, and my a broken head.
What made you go back?
Well, it was still, I mean, when I left, it was still left in kind of a threatening situation. I mean, it was still the same thing. I mean, you tell me you're going to break my legs and, you know, you got it in front of you, you're going to have to do it, you know, and maybe you can, but it's, you know, that's, it's just there.
What about something like calling the police?
And saying what?
That you've been threatened and you know who the person is?
No, that doesn't. I'm not interested in getting tied up in some kind of a police, you know, making out complaints and spending any time in court. And I'm not particularly, you know, I didn't feel like, you know, I'd rather not get into the actual particulars of the thing, but, you know, I didn't feel that's not the kind of thing that would call for that. Those people didn't deserve to be in trouble with the police.
My guest is Pete Dexter, if you're just joining us. And any other columns that come to mind that you'd want to discuss that were controversial, either at the paper or among listeners, readers?
No, I mean, if something came up, I'd be glad to talk about it. I can't.
Okay. Do you think there's a difference in approach between male and female columnists?
Well, I think there's a difference between approach of just about any columnist. I don't think there's one set of rules for men and one set for women.
The columnist who is in your novel says at one point when they tell him that they're going to hire a woman columnist to write opposite him at the paper, says that they have nothing to write about except rape clubs and vaginal diseases, though he uses a different word instead of vaginal. What do you think of that comment?
You mean, do I agree with it?
Well,
I think that's exactly what the guy who says that is the. I mean, I think I think that's a exactly accurate thing for that person to say under those circumstances. If you ask me if that's what I think, no.
Are you comfortable writing about your family in your column? And are they comfortable? Is your wife comfortable with you writing about her?
Yeah, she doesn't. I mean, it's not. I don't write anything serious about my family except, I mean, the things I write about my wife and my child and what goes on there are almost all written in a playful way. I don't explore any kind of a serious relationship between myself and my wife. I don't write anything that would threaten her or myself. You know, it's just done in kind of a lighter vein.
There was a recent column in which several people wrote in accusing you of being racist because of things that you'd said in the past few weeks. When do you feel like it's time to address these things in print?
You mean when do I run a letters column?
Mm-hmm.
Usually when I'm real busy and, you know, don't have time to write a regular column. It wasn't because the letters had piled up off the desk or anything. And it depends, too, on the letters. I'd never run a letters column where I write, you know, 4 out of 5 letters you get say, you know, I love you and, you know, my family likes your stuff and, you know, you mean so much to my mother or something. You don't run those. But when somebody's got a legitimate something to say or something that really, you know, sticks in you, then you write it.
Do you take it to heart when you get, like, say, 5 letters, or I don't know, you printed about 5, I don't know how many you really got, saying that with what you're writing, we think you're racist?
No. You read the letters, and you get a guy reading, you know, who's read one letters column, writes in to tell me I'm a racist, and that doesn't bother me. I mean, the person doesn't have, I mean, if you're not going to take the time and the energy and the effort, if you're not smart enough to read that column and figure out whether what I'm talking about is racism or not, I don't care.
Who are the national columnists who you have read and who have been important to you?
None of them are important to me. The ones I enjoy, I think Royko is good sometimes. As I said before, I think McMullen at the Daily News is as good as anybody when he's on. I think Breslin, when he's good, is great. I thought Hamill was fine when he was on. Oh, there's any number of people. I mean, you're writing 3 days a week, you know, every week for a year, you're going to hit it sometimes. But those are the people that come to mind, first of all.
Maury Kempton. Mm-hmm. Do you think Philadelphia is a good city for local columnists?
Boy, it sure is. There's about 400 of them. Yeah, there's a lot to do here. And I think it's saturated right now. It's not, I mean, there's too many, there's probably too many of us. But sure, it's a good city.
What's the problem with there being too many?
Well, it's just the balance between, you know, opinion and news swings pretty high toward opinion in our paper. It's just a matter of, you know, to my mind, it might be too high, but I don't run the paper, and I don't know.
Do you miss the Bulletin?
Yeah. I'm really sorry. That's something I still think about, because I know some people who, you know, who work there and still never been able to get jobs again. You know, a lot of them because they couldn't move out of Philadelphia. Yeah, I thought that was really a tragedy. And I'm real sorry it happened. You know, I can't really say anything more than that, except, you know, I am genuinely sorry.
Do you miss the competition?
No, because it wasn't set up to give me competition. I mean, everybody in the newspaper is trying to sell each other, but there wasn't anybody doing what I do there.
Do you think that there are some people who don't read the daily news because it's in tabloid style, because of all the...
Sure.
All the meaning that people give to the tabloid.
Sure, there are. Yeah, and they're cheating themselves, I think. Yeah, there's a lot of people that, you know, who make it a point to tell me that they don't read the daily news, they just read the Inquirer. And if you take the daily news is flat a better written newspaper, and it covers this city better. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's a much better newspaper than Inquirer right now. It doesn't have the depth or the international reporting or the national reporting. But damn it, we do the city better than anybody, and we, you know, we've got like at least twice the writers as far as, you know, that I see. That doesn't mean they don't have any good ones, just we get a whole bunch.
My guess is Pete Dexter, who's a columnist for the Daily News, also a columnist for Esquire magazine, and author of the new novel, God's Pocket, which has just been published by Random House. And we're going to open up the telephones and invite you to call if you have any questions that you'd like to ask them. Our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. That's 923-2774. If you have any questions or comments for writer Pete Dexter. You've been, for the past few months, writing for Esquire magazine, and it's a sports column. It's called Sports Scene. Was it your idea or their idea to focus the column on sports?
It was their, boy, I sound funny in these things.
Yeah. You just put on the headphones.
Yeah, it was their idea. We did sports. I wanted to do a column. My idea was digits.
Digits?
Which, yeah, I've been around an awful lot around the country. You know, I come from different places, and I run into a lot of people with missing fingers and toes, and I always ask them about, you know, how it happened. And invariably, it's a funny story. I mean, you just hear the greatest stories about people's fingers and toes. And I thought, I mean, I didn't really have much hope that Philip Moffat was going to like the idea, but when they first started talking to me about a column, I said, well, let's just do, you know, one on people with, you know, how they lost fingers and stuff. And then my friend Betsy Carter, who was the senior executive editor there, she said, well, what about sports instead? And that's how it, and I'm interested in sports. I mean, I enjoy sports.
We used to play football, didn't you?
Yeah, I was just pitifully mediocre football player.
Did I understand that you had a dislocated hip from a fall in football?
Yeah. Would you? I don't really talk too much about my medical problems.
No problem. Well, let's take our first phone call, and we still have some open lines. If you have any questions or comments for Pete Dexter, it's 923-2774. We're at area code 215. Again, that's 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to ask, because Pete's working for Gil Spencer, whom I think is a pretty good editor, what he thinks makes a good editor, and how much does a good editor assist him?
Well, Spencer helps me in that, I mean, Gil Spencer is the person I answer to, and there's nobody between me and him, and that's a real valuable thing. I think the strongest thing he has going for him is a sense of humor. I mean, and you need it. I mean, running a newspaper, if you take it all seriously, boy, you're going to go nuts. And he's, you know, he's a very human guy, and I mean, he's probably the most loved person in that building, although, you know, not by me this week, but next week I'll love him again. He's really a likable, he's the kind of person that you want to do things for.
Does an editor help a columnist, or are you pretty much strung out on your own?
No, he doesn't help. I mean, you mean help write it?
No, help you in suggestions and guidance and encouragement. backing you up?
Yeah, he will back me up. That's, you know, there's no question at all when you got some trouble, you know, Spencer will be there behind you. But for, you know, for ideas or anything like that, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, he writes one column a week himself, and it's, you know, he's in there all night Friday trying to think of that idea. And if he had two, he'd just save the next one for next week.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Thank you, Pete, very much.
Yep.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. If you have any questions, our number is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Dexter going back to the bar with his boxer friend and disagree vehemently with the liberal, in quotation marks, attitude of you, Ms. Gross, because, as the 18th century poet Robert Burns said, a man's a man for all that and for what happened, and I don't want to go into ridiculous because he doesn't. You don't go to the cops. You go back and you beat A.
Well, yeah, that's not really even what we had in mind. That wasn't, you know, that wouldn't have been any fairer than what happened the first time. I mean, I didn't go in there with Randall Cobb to beat up a bar. That wasn't it. We just went in there to get some things straightened out. But, you know, I think we said enough about that, unless you want to say something else. You weren't there, were you?
That, nope. I'll take another phone call, and our number is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I just called to commend Pete Dexter on the stand he took on that the Rizzo PDW story, specifically in regard that Argon editorial.
Yeah.
And a Lawler cartoon. And he, and I think it was another stand you took last year on the Dubajkowski column on Maury Povich.
Right.
That's all I call for. Just
Well, the Daily News is a place where I don't know how many other people do it, but I feel free to, when I see something that I think we do wrong, I will bring it up. But I think it's also important to remember that just because, you know, Argood and I disagree about an editorial or that Rob Lawler writes a, you know, draws a cartoon that I think is cheap, that doesn't mean it's cheap or that I'm right. It's just what I think, and it certainly doesn't mean that I think everything Argood writes is wrong. Or that everything that Lawler draws is cheap.
That's to be risky business, though, you know, so that's why I called to commend you.
Okay, well, thank you for the call.
Right.
Thanks for your call. Is there any policy at the paper about when it's okay to say something negative about somebody else's work on staff?
No, we don't have hardly any policies at all. It's, it would just be something that, you know, you wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it lightly. I don't think anybody there would do it lightly. And, you know, you wouldn't do it without thinking about it. But, you know, we're public, too. I mean, we're not exempt from criticism, and I don't think anybody there would want us to be.
Let's take another phone call.
I wouldn't mind being exempt from criticism. Hope Argood didn't write anything about me.
Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Well, first of all, I'd like to suggest to Mr. Dexter that he use the column on digits in the National Lampoon. And I would just like to know what you feel about the Esquire now as opposed to what it was like in the early 70s. When I used to read it all the time and enjoyed it a lot.
The Inquirer, did you say, or Esquire?
Esquire.
The Esquire magazine.
I think, I don't know about the early 70s, going back into the 60s when... You know, when it was real thick and square and you couldn't read the inside, you know what I'm talking about? When you open the thing up, and you couldn't read the column closest, all the words in the columns closest to the crack. And you could never tell what was going to be in that magazine. It was always a surprise. It was just the best things they could put together. I loved that magazine
really?
Then.
It was very good.
And I think that it I mean, it was right on the verge of bankruptcy two or three times. It almost went out of business. And if I think they tried to make it, well, it is useful now. It's more useful than it used to be. But I loved it. I loved it the way it was when it was just writers. Yeah, and you could just pick it up and you never had any idea what would be inside it. I don't dislike it now.
What do you think it's going to be like in the future?
God, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't really read the guy that owns it, Philip Moffitt, very well yet. I've only sat down with him once. And I don't know where he's going with it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks
thank
for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I was sort of interested in the book, particularly after the McNeil Lehrer review a couple of nights ago.
How was that?
Excuse me?
How was that?
Very good. The reviewer, I don't remember who, liked the book a lot. But I'm a little surprised at the view of women that the reporter seems to project based on that quote that you used earlier. Is that the view of women that's projected throughout the book?
No, see, this is one, I mean, these people, the book doesn't, you know, the characters in the book have different ways of looking at women because they're different people. That's an accurate reflection of what one character in the book, you know, thinks of women. I can't remember what quote we're talking about here, but there are people.
Something about the new columnist who was coming on and what they could write about.
Yeah, rape, clubs, and disease, yeah. No, yeah, that certainly isn't, you know, the thought behind the book. That is a reflection of the person, on the person who said it. It's got nothing to do with what women columnists are really about.
Is there any change in his view at the end of the book?
No, you mean along women's rights view? No, see, this guy is locked into who he is and what he is, and he's, you know, this is the columnist that. He doesn't have anything except his column, and he even hates that. And no, there's no change possible for that guy, and there's no redemption possible. And that's a sad situation to be in.
Okay, but thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Do you ever find in like bars you're hanging out when someone knows who you are that a man will come up to you and try to impress you with like what a man he is and how truly macho he is? And if that happens, how do you react to it?
No. Well, see, first of all, I don't hang around bars too much. I did more of it, I used to do more of it. But that happens more with Randall, my friend, the heavyweight fighter. I mean, people are always coming up and talking about how they used to, who they fought and stuff. And it's just kind of funny because the real bad people don't talk about it. I get more people come up and want to talk about things they've written.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I try to be... I try to really be patient with that. If they're not being a complete pain in the ass about it, I will listen, and I never have very much advice for anybody because I don't have too much good advice even for myself. As I think we proved tonight. But I'll always listen and I'll always, I'll always say what I think. I mean, I won't tell somebody you stink. I mean, I'll always try to, because it's not an easy thing to do to be a writer. And I know the kind of insecurity you have. Even I'm fairly visible, and I'm fairly visible, and I can I have access to a lot of different kind of magazines and stuff. So I don't have that kind of insecurity of wondering if I can get published, and I'm still that way. I still worry about it, and it's still hard. I know what it's like for the other end.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Our number, if you have any questions for Pete Dexter, is 923-2774. He's written a new novel titled God's Pocket. He's also writing an Esquire magazine monthly column in addition to his daily news columns. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I had two questions. One is, how did Pete Dexter make his World Series prediction last year? The other is more technical about getting a novel read, much less published. In my case, I've got a textbook published. I thought I would have my foot in the door, and I can't get the novel read. I don't know if you could give any general advice on that.
Do you have an agent?
No. But that seems to be harder than getting it published. Getting an agent who says, well, you don't have to have two novels published already. Or
Yeah, I don't really, you know, I'm not very good at this kind of stuff because, you know, I didn't really go through it. I mean, I had, once you get, you start publishing stuff in national magazines, agents, you know, call you. I don't mean this in any kind of, you know, superior way or anything.
Mm.
It's just what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one day an agent called me and had talked to a woman up at Franklin Watts Publishing, and she'd said that, you know, they were talking about Philadelphia writers, and I was, you know, she'd said she'd publish anything I wrote.
Mm.
And so I just wrote this novel. I mean, it ended up with Random House, but it, you know, that's, I don't know what to tell you except that I'm sure that it's a lot better with an agent than it is without.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Pete Dexter's. I like him very much, especially because he isn't in a liberal or conservative bag, and he's not predictable, and he's always refreshing to read. I wanted to ask Pete, a recent column he wrote about Jesse Jackson's remarks, I wasn't quite sure I understood what his attitude was toward Jackson. If I correctly recall the column, it seemed to me that you basically didn't like the fact that his private remarks were reported, and that was kind of the basis of the column. I'd like to kind of clarify how you feel about the remarks that Jackson said and his reaction afterward to it.
Right. I think that I think if Jesse Jackson says Hymie Town, you know, in the privacy of a, you know, in a private conversation, that's his own business. I don't think it matters if you say Jaime or any other, you know, I don't think the racial words matter as much as how you treat people. And I think Jesse Jackson's, I mean, I'm not a big supporter of him, but I don't think you can fault his record on, you know, that way. And I don't think that a Washington Post reporter picking up those words, and I don't think that should become an issue at all. I would hate to have everything I'd ever said published in a newspaper.
The thing, I had recently read an article in the New Republic on the Jackson remarks, which seemed to indicate that that wasn't the first time that he'd made kind of inflammatory remarks that could be construed as being anti-Semitic. And my problem with it was, first off, that, and I'm not Jewish, but the thing is, I kind of took offense to it because, first off, I think sometimes the only way you can really read politicians is what they say in private rather than what they say on the record and how they term people. And certainly Jackson's his politics toward Israel have always had a decidedly pro-Arab slant, the embrace of Yasser Arafat and people like that. And it just seemed to tie together that, and his reaction to it was that he felt he was being picked on because he was black, and I kind of felt that the situation had been the other way around and a Walter Mondale or somebody like that had used the word nigger in private, they probably wouldn't still be in the race. I kind of felt that Jackson got off rather easily. The other candidates were afraid to attack him too much, trying to avoid offending the black constituency.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with what you said. I mean, if Walter Mondale had said nigger, it would have been, you know, you would have heard about it from there on in. I don't think you get much of a look at people from their private conversations. I know that I spend, you know, a lot of time writing things down, and at the end of the year I'll look back and there's 8 or 10 things I wrote that I probably, you know, didn't mean, and I'm writing them down and looking at them. I think that what you do is you judge people on how they treat other people. And what I've seen of Jesse Jackson, I've never seen him. You know, I've seen him a few times in person, and I've never seen him. I've never seen him just give the back of his hand to people because they weren't, you know, important. I've never seen him ignore people who were trying to talk to him, you know, black or white. And, you know, he may have some faults, but I don't, you know, I don't think that that's the thing to jump on.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Yeah, he may be right, too. I mean, I may be wrong.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. And yeah, please keep your question brief, because we're just about out of time.
Pete Dexter is one of the few columnists that I can read and enjoy, even when I totally disagree with him, and that's a rare gift. Two, I want to ask what he thinks the role of a columnist is, rather to be an advocacy for a given group that might be slighted, for the media to represent certain ideas. Just what does he think a general columnist should do?
Well, it depends on the columnist. I just try to tell stories the way I see them. And, you know, when something makes me mad, I react to it. And I think it really helps if you can make people smile or make them laugh. But I think you're there. I mean, I think you either got to be entertaining or have something to say. And there's nobody that has something good to say all the time. So when you can't do that, you should be able to fall back on making people smile.
Okay, thanks for your call. And that's all the time we're going to have for phone calls this afternoon. I know you're living in the Pine Barrens now. What did you decide to live in the country as opposed to in the city, since I think of the Daily News as being such an urban paper?
Well, it is an urban paper. I'm not an urban person. I'm moving farther away soon. I don't like the noise. I like to leave the doors open where I live. You know, that's how I was brought up. I'm from South Dakota. I'm not from a city, and that's how I'm comfortable. I don't want my daughter running around. And that doesn't mean that anybody that does live here is wrong. It's just, you know, how I'm comfortable.
Okay. I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having
me. For talking with us. My guest has been Pete Dexter, who is a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and also now writes a monthly Esquire magazine column called Sports Scene. He's also written a novel. It's called God's Pocket, and that novel has just been published by Random House.